Good afternoon, and welcome to the Sitka Nature Show. This is your host, Matt. I want to thank you for joining me here as we are into the second half of January 2021. We are just under 4 weeks past the winter solstice, and given the weather, you could be forgiven for not noticing that our day length is increasing slowly at first, but will be more rapidly increasing in the coming weeks. Sunset is now at almost 4 p.m., about a half an hour past where it was at the winter solstice. But our heavy overcast conditions with lots of rain and wind so far this year have kind of dominated my experience. I don't believe we've had a sunny day all year, but there has been a couple of minor sun breaks along the way. I was able to get out and get some photos of the brambling, which is still around, and looking forward to some sunshine forecast for later in the coming week. We'll see if it holds up. I imagine it won't be stormy all winter. But I have been noticing the buoy out at Cape Edgecombe Buoy has been continuously almost just only brief drops below 10-foot seas out there, with a number of peaks over 20, some approaching 30-foot seas as these repeated storms coming out of the Bering Sea and the Aleutians moving across the Gulf of Alaska. Or not necessarily moving across, but just being so large to encompass the entire Gulf of Alaska. It's been a volatile time for weather for sure this year so far. Despite the challenging weather, I've been making an effort to get out at least a little bit each day to see what I can see out there. I use the new year as motivation to seek out the species that are around this time of year and add them to my year list of species seen. And this year I'm trying to get photographs of everything I can as well. It's also been nice to see some of the less typical species. Thick-billed murre has been showing up from time to time at Sawmill Cove and in Silver Bay. Yellow-billed loon has been frequenting the harbors and harbor area around Sitka. The brambling has continued at the location there on Japonski Island, where it's been seen since last fall. And just this past week, Karen Johnson found a Townsend's solitaire, which is an unusual bird for Sitka. So it was nice to get a chance to view that. And I know several other folks were able to see it as well. If you've been getting out, I'd love to hear what you're seeing out there. Please feel free to send me an email, sitkanature@gmail.com, or get on Facebook and like the Sitka Nature page there. The conversation I have for this week's show is one I recorded and originally aired in early 2016. I spoke with Katie Birch, a marine educator and illustrator who was in town to give a talk as part of the Natural History Seminar series. She is co-author on a small guide to the marine phytoplankton of Ketchmack Bay and was coordinating a citizen science monitoring program of the phytoplankton of Ketchmack Bay. Well, go ahead and join the conversation with me, asking her a little bit about phytoplankton as I spoke with her before I had a chance to see her talk. So you're here to talk about phytoplankton, and I actually don't know that much about phytoplankton except for that there's a lot of different kinds of them. They're very small. They live in the ocean. Well, I don't, maybe they can live in freshwater too. I don't know.
Yep, they can.
In freshwater also. Yep. And they're the phyto part means that they're photosynthetic.
Is that, you've got a good base going
that,
there. Yeah.
That kind of the start.
I could skip half my slideshow with you and just get into the good stuff.
I guess there's a lot of them out there, and I've heard these things about nutrients and different kinds and climate change and all sorts of stuff, but I don't really actually know that much about phytoplankton and kind of the Gulf of Alaska. And it seems like, so you've been studying them out of Homer area in particular.
Yeah. And the part about what I know that's kind of interesting is I'm not a phytoplankton researcher per se.
Oh, okay.
So I am running a citizen science program where I have people taking water samples and turning them into me. So I kind of coordinate these local people. But the cool thing is through our program, we're getting a pretty good look at what's happening. And there aren't a lot of people looking, researching phytoplankton and coming up with some of the stuff that we're coming up with just with local folks in the bay. So that's kind of cool. So we're getting a pretty good look at what phytoplankton we have and when it blooms. And these are some things that may not necessarily attract research.
Yeah.
And we do have some
it's kind of like the phenology of...
Exactly. Yeah. And so if someone doesn't know what phenology is, I always explain it like... a phonology chart or a phonology calendar would be like if you kept track of all the first time you saw a flower blooming mm-hmm. throughout the summer. So it would be like daffodils and then lupin and such. And then that's what we've been kind of focusing on with phytoplankton.
So are you identifying them like to individual species or does it tend to be groups? Or?
Yeah, it's mostly, I'd say the genus okay. because there are so many of them. There's just thousands of species. And I think sometimes we don't have that many different kinds of species, but there's not that many avenues or resources for us to actually get a specialist to tell us exactly yeah. what we have. So, we're basically identifying it to group or genus okay. at this point.
Yeah, so it's one of those things, and I've run into this with like insects around here, for example. It's like, if you knew what was here, it's not that hard to tell what it is, but getting the name in the first place is kind of the difficult thing, because globally speaking, it can be difficult to tell. There's probably only one thing here, you know, in a case of an insect. That looks like that, but yeah, I don't have the expertise myself to go through the literature.
And then what's challenging nowadays in a lot of arenas with natural history is that with climate change, you know, you might have your guidebook that's going to tell you what is in temperate waters, but we're seeing things that aren't supposed to be here.
Mm.
You know, like we had a bloom in Ketchumak Bay that was just brown. Everyone was saying it was like root beer. And we had foam on the shores and our waters were brown. Everyone was freaking out. And, you know, so we collect the water, look at it under the scope. I've never seen this thing before. And so I actually just used Google Images and found something that looked the same, found something that was similar in the guidebook just to get some kind of a name to throw into Google. And so then I get a hold of and actually this just happened to be right during that federal shutdown a couple years ago.
Okay.
So like the NOAA scientists that I normally go to with things like this weren't at work. And anyway, it was a pretty funny story. But anyway, finally, when I got a hold of someone, I said, I think it's this. What do you think it is? I think it's this. And they said, well, yeah, if you were in the Gulf of Mexico,
right.
I would say that's what you're seeing. But yes, indeed, that's what we had. And it was the first recorded bloom of Carina mikimotoi, which is a dinoflagellate, in Alaska. And here it's way up by Homer, you know?
Yeah.
So, and then we're also seeing other phytoplankton that when you know, just look in the guidebook, it's not going to tell you that it's saying, you know, rarely found in cold water.
Mm-hmm.
And here we have it in Ketchumak Bay. So it's kind of an exciting time for all kinds of areas of natural history, like I said, because we're undergoing a lot of changes right now.
Yeah, I'd be curious, you know, I suppose the challenging part is always like how much of it's actually different and how much of it is that just nobody actually looked here before. And with Alaska especially, you know, these little I was talking to one person who says, you know, it's kind of funny. If you look at the range maps of a lot of these marine organisms, marine invertebrates and stuff, they always end at where there just happened to be a field station, surprisingly.
And where someone was actually looking close enough to find them.
Right, exactly. And so it's almost certainly the case that the ranges aren't, but that's where people have found them. And so people are not looking across whole swaths of things. And I don't have a huge, you know, I understand that Homer is kind of on the south end of the Kenai Peninsula down there, maybe at the very tip. Is that
pretty much? Yeah. There's kind of a wild mountainous peninsula that sticks out a little past us, but we're just one bay in from that.
All right. And Ketchumak Bay is kind of, I've heard of that. Homer's situated there, and it's kind of a rich environment. It sounds like a lot of sort of seabirds and stuff coming there, especially in the winter.
We're kind of on the edge. So if you picture like Anchorage is up at the top of Cook Inlet, most people probably know what Cook Inlet is. And then right at the bottom of Cook Inlet, the Cook Inlet empties out into the Gulf of Alaska.
Yeah, okay.
So we're just right, I guess it would be northeast of Kodiak there.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a lot of upwelling and waters that come up. The coastal current is a major current up along the shoreline of Alaska, and it runs north. So it goes up southeast, up around and comes around the Gulf. So that when that upwelling comes up at the base or at the outflow, I guess, of Cook Inlet, that's a really rich area. And Ketchumak Bay is also a very rich area. And we're considered an estuary.
Oh, okay.
It doesn't look like it's not an estuary in the winter.
Oh, right.
But in the summer we are because we have a lot of glaciers melting.
Okay.
So we have a lot of fresh water. So, of course, estuary is fresh from salt water mixing. And that always makes a rich area. And the other reason why we have a lot of species is because we're kind of right on the line of a couple different kind of, I guess you could call it biozones or different zones. And so we get some Arctic species and we get some southern species, and we're a little bit of a mix. We're right on the edge there.
Yeah, I've known. I guess it's maybe Seward isn't that far from there, but like that's kind of that zone is where you run out of the really that temperate rainforest species, chestnut-backed chickadees, and the birds and things like that that are really common here and go well south of here. But that's kind of where they end, and you get into this more like fire-prone and boreal forest type stuff as you get up into Anchorage and that. So it's this, I guess, you know, terrestrial, kind of that transition zone.
Yeah.
And then marine-wise, I guess there's probably a lot of stuff moving out of Cook Inlet, you know, just in terms of stuff that's washed down.
Yeah, a lot of – it's real silty. There's a lot of big glacial rivers that empty into Cook Inlet. We have big tides, and Cook Inlet itself has a lot of sandy beaches. It's kind of a – almost like a scrubby pad going back and forth.
Yeah.
You know, it's real silty. Where Ketchmack Bay is a little bit rockier. It's a little bit more of a rocky intertidal on the south side. And we have some glacial water, but it's not quite as thick as Cook Inlet.
And temperature-wise, I guess my assumption would be that it would be like colder than here. You know, water-wise probably and air temperature-wise as well. But it's still pretty moderate, I would imagine.
Yeah. Yeah, and Anchorage temperatures are always cooler than we are.
Yeah.
And then, of course, it's like you guys next to the ocean where you're going to be cooler in the summer, warmer in the winter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so so you've been, as you said, you were working in a citizen science project and really just like, you know, from the beach or the dock or something, just like dragging a net through the water, or you're going out on a boat and doing bigger transects or some of both.
Yeah, so we do have some other projects going on in the bay, not our organization. I work for the Ketchmack Bay Research Reserve. But there's a Gulf Watch project that's doing some plankton toes from boat, and they're doing zooplankton and phytoplankton. But the citizen science program that I coordinate, we just have a small plankton net, a couple feet, maybe 2-3 feet long, and we our protocol is just to run it through the water from a dock or a boat for 3 minutes, and then you pull it up, and what it does is it just concentrates, and the net size, the mesh size, I guess you could say, is super tiny, so it's catching phytoplankton, and then when you run it through the water for 3 minutes, basically what you're doing is concentrating it so that when you take a drop, you can only look at like one drop at a time under a microscope. So when you take that drop, you have a lot to look at. Where if you just took your water bottle and stuck it in the water and took a drop of that, you might have to load your slide and look at many microscopic views to see a good selection of what's out there. So, because with our citizen science program, we are not like counting how many cells per liter. This is a qualitative study. So we're basically saying this is what's out there. And and when something's abundant or in a bloom stage, we take note of that.
Mm-hmm.
But we're not doing the real scientific, like counting every phyto. I have done that.
Yeah.
And I would have a real hard time rounding up volunteers to do that.
I remember a student kind of working on that when I was teaching at Sheldon Jackson. And I was like, well, yeah. But for you guys, I suppose that makes it simpler. You don't have to like have volumes of water that you're filtering or anything.
And it is hard. If you just take your plankton net, which basically looks like a ring about 8 inches across with like a pantyhose attached with a bottle on the end, that's basically what they look like. Then, you know, it's really hard to measure how much water is going in that net.
Yeah.
So you either have to like take buckets full of water and pour them into the phytoplankton net if you want to measure cells per liter and you want to know exactly how much water you're filtering. Or if you're on a bigger boat and a bigger net, they actually have these little flow meters that kind of estimate. But that would be more a big thing that you'd drag behind a boat, probably more for zooplankton.
And I suppose, I mean, no doubt there are techniques for estimating essentially based on a sample how much the total amount is. But, you know, I guess, you know, here talking to people that snorkel or scuba dive or even just people out on the water, you know, there's a clear difference in how far you can see down into the water based on the time of year. And I guess my understanding is excepting those times when there's like some rain event and a lot of, you know, sediment is into the water, but we don't have you know, with not really a lot of glaciers here, it's not sediment loaded water, right, generally speaking. But that's mostly, is it mostly phytoplankton or a mix of phytoplankton?
Yeah, well,
and
there'll
zooplankton,
be zooplankton in there, but phytoplankton are the more numerous.
Okay.
And they're usually the thing that has enough of them to actually turn the water a color.
Yeah.
I have had blooms that were caused by very tiny animals or very tiny zooplankton, but mm-hmm. usually when the water gets kind of cloudy, greenish looking, that's from phytoplankton. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of fun to keep track or think about when that bloom happens in April, usually for us, it's early April, is really a big thing in the ocean. Like when that phytoplankton bloom takes off, that really kicks off all kinds of life that's going to happen that summer in the ocean. And because we're so far north, our winters are fairly unproductive times. And a lot of it is because most of the productivity starts with phytoplankton. And if you don't have enough sun to photosynthesize, you're not going to be out there. So the phytoplankton numbers really fall down in the winter, and it's kind of a dormant time really for productivity. But as soon as that sun comes back and there's enough of it and those phytoplankton take off, it can be an exponential bloom. And that's probably what anyone who works on the water has probably seen, where all of a sudden it's like, well, the water was really clear yesterday, and boom, you know, it's like, you know, that kind of that greenish cloudy color.
Yeah.
And those cells, these single-celled organisms called phytoplankton, they're actually an algae. And so how they reproduce is just cell division. And so they can really reproduce very quickly. And
is that a combination of temperature and light, or is it primarily just light? Or?
Temperature does have something to do with it, but it's more the light.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have to think about not only day length, like, oh, well, wouldn't they always bloom on the same day because our day length increases to a certain point? But then if you have a cloudy week, you're not getting as much sunlight. And they actually have instruments in the water. I'm sure you guys have them here with some of your water quality programs, but it's called PAR, and it actually measures how much sunlight is going into the water.
So like light intensity.
Yeah. And when that reaches, some people think when that reaches a certain number, that's enough to trigger a phytoplankton.
So it basically is adding it up over days or weeks, or as opposed to just like and maybe you don't know the answer to this. I'd never actually considered this before. I don't know where phytoplankton go when they're not around. I mean, like, is there always just a few in there and those are what suddenly explode, or are they like dormant somewhere and then they activate?
Yeah,
or
that's a really good question. So a lot of times there's just a low level of them mm-hmm. around, but they do have what they call resting spores.
Mm-hmm.
And so in a time where they're just, it doesn't pay for them to be trying to survive, they will kind of encapsulate and make a resting spore, and they can just hang out in the sediment of the body of water, whether it's freshwater, marine, and then when everything's right, boom, up they come, and they can start a big bloom from those spores.
And then move up the water column, essentially.
Yeah.
'Cause I guess I don't know, like, some little microorganisms have little flagelli thing, I don't remember all the names for the little moving bits that help them kind of, like, I don't get the impression that it's extremely efficient for like directional movement, but it gets them moving in any case.
Yeah.
I don't know. Do phytoplankton have that, or are they pretty much?
Well, there's a couple groups. So there's the interesting thing about plankton. When you hear the word plankton, that word describes a lifestyle.
Okay.
It's not really describing a taxonomic group. So there are, right now anyway, until the scientists or the taxonomists find something else or decide to divide things up anyway, there's six categories of kingdoms of life, right?
Mm-hmm.
You got your animals, your plants, on and on. So there are actually six categories, and only one of them is not represented in plankton. So you could be a little animal and be considered plankton. You'd be considered a zooplankton. You could be a small fungi, you could be a bacteria, or you could be a protist. And so if you're a protist and you have chlorophyll and you can make energy from the sun, you are an algae, and that is what most phytoplankton is. So that, did I totally confuse you?
No, so and I guess I mean, imagine it varies depending on marine and freshwater.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, the ratios of things tend to be different. But,
yep.
But like, the zooplankton, there are things that whose entire life is tiny.
Yep.
But then there are a lot of things that we recognize as more macro invertebrates whose part of whose life is tiny.
Yep.
You know, I guess krill is kind of one of those, and I guess they're not super tiny, but they're, like, we hear about them because whales eat them.
Yeah, and they're considered planktonic because they can't really motor around super good on their own. So they're at the mercy, anything that's at the mercy of the tide and current
okay.
is considered planktonic. So you know those big mola molas or those big sunfish?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So they're like these really bizarre fish with a dorsal fin and a pectoral fin, but they don't have a tail, basically. They have nothing that propels them through the water.
Mm-hmm.
And they are also considered planktonic, even though they could be as big as your kitchen table.
Wow. So that would be not microscopic.
No, but it's considered yeah. plankton because they can't really move around. And luckily, or not luckily, but coincidentally, they eat jellyfish, which are also planktonic.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't know if you've ever gone to those aquariums down south where they have jellyfish in the tanks.
Mm-hmm.
And they had, you know, in the big aquarium areas, and they had to specially design those tanks because you have to keep those jellyfish moving or they'll just all like pile up in the corner. Like,
yeah.
They don't have any real self-determination.
Yeah.
They have to just go with the tide and the currents.
Yeah.
And so anyway, lots of things that float around are called plankton, and then there's all these different groups.
So, yeah. So plankton is basically your drifting, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you might have some mobility, but not a lot of it. The extent of it you have mobility tends to be more random walk style mobility. Like, you can move around in an area, but without any real sense of direction.
Yeah. But some of them are, they're more interested, some of the zooplankton especially, they're a little bit more interested in where they are mm-hmm. vertically.
Oh,
like,
okay.
Whether they're up or down in the water, then they are like, oh, I want to go over here to this harbor or that harbor. They're more interested in the up and down. It has more effect on them
mm-hmm.
because, of course, if you're a zooplankton and you're eating phytoplankton, the phytoplankton are all going to be near the surface because they're trying to get as much sun as they can. So if you're a zooplankton, you're going to be going up to get your phytoplankton. But then there's also other stuff trying to eat you. If you want to get eaten, you might want to go down. So a lot of zooplankton have kind of a day-night up and
okay.
down cycle.
Yeah.
And it also could have things to do with, you know, we look at water, it just looks like one big homogenous bathtub of water, you know. But there's a lot going on in the ocean with there's like layers of water, mm-hmm. fresh water, salt water, warm water, cold water. There's different currents, like rips. If you're out in the water, a fisherman, you know about rips and different current speeds. And so if you're just a little tiny guy down there, that could be like a brick wall
yeah.
for you. So the movement of these things is kind of dictated by a lot of things that we don't see.
Yeah. Yeah, and I suppose at their scale, I mean, that might be things that we wouldn't have any – even if we were in the water, we wouldn't notice.
Right.
Because
and the
we're big
smaller
enough.
– this is something someone told me that I never thought of. But the smaller you are – the more viscous water is,
oh,
so the
okay.
thicker it feels.
Huh.
So, like, for us, it's like, it's pretty thick, but it's not too thick, you know?
Yeah.
But if you're just this little microscopic thing, it might, I don't know what it feels like, but it might feel like you're swimming in Jell-O or something.
Huh.
I don't know.
Yeah.
So, it's you know, it's a different perspective that we, you know, and I think also we, or myself, you know, years of being a fisherman on the water before I kind of got into this more scientific end of things, you know, you just kind of see the surface of the water.
Yeah.
And you're just kind
yeah.
of guessing at what goes on. But there's just so much, you know, and the more you learn about it, the more when you look across the water, you're kind of visualizing, like, I'm imagining like a longliner or, you know, they can like visualize the bottom when they're looking at something. You
yeah.
know? But I think a lot of us that aren't working real closely with the ocean, you just kind of see this flat surface on the top.
Yeah. Reminds me of is my brother's experience snorkeling for the first time. And we both grew up here, but we never snorkeled. I still haven't snorkeled, but it's something that I want to do now. But a friend of his, he's
snorkeling here.
Yeah,
he
got invited to go snorkeling here, just like off the beach, you know, a place that we've been a lot of times before.
Yeah.
And he said it was amazing because you know, he was in there and it was this big space of like, and of course everything, when you see it out of the water, it's just not really where it's supposed to be. It's just sort of hunkered down and trying to survive.
Yeah, kind of closed up, yeah.
And so in the water, you know, the seaweed's up and the algae's up and then the critters are moving around and doing their thing. And he said it was like this big space and he just felt like he was just in this immense space. And then he bumped his knee and he's like, he was in a foot and a half of water. And it's like, but the feeling of it was just immense. And, uh-huh. And that is, you know, even more so, no doubt, you know, as you get deeper. But yeah, we just don't have this. Yeah. We're essentially, because we're sort of limited to land, yeah. and the surface, it's hard. It is hard to kind of, imagine, I guess, what it's like for all these creatures moving up and down with day and night and
yeah.
and the, you know, interactions of predators and prey and all those kind of things.
Yeah,
and
one of my favorite moments that kind of just reminded me of just your story about your brother, just kind of an aha moment, was just, you know, learning about plankton, studying about it. And I remember a speaker came to Homer and he had this quote that he, or just a phrase that stuck in my head, and it was nature explores opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
And that really went off in my head when I was trying to wrap my head around, well, what, you know, I was trying to wrap my head around phytoplankton. You know, I grew up in Minnesota, so it was all like foreign concept to me. And wait a minute, you got algae? Like, isn't algae that scum on the rocks? You know, how can algae be floating around producing all this stuff? And then it kind of hit me, you know, really what drives all life on the earth is the sun. Right. So on, you know, you go for a walk here in Sitka or anywhere, like all these plants are competing for the sun. Like everyone's competing in the forest for that little ray of sun. If I grow my branch out here, maybe I'll get a little bit more. Or in a salt marsh, like, well, maybe if I learn how to deal with salt, I'll be able to be the only guy out there in the marsh to get sunlight, you know. But then if you think 71% of our planet is water. And so if sun is driving all life on the planet, the plants are all on land. We know about plants because we're on land with them and we see them. But who's taking advantage of all the sun that's hitting the surface of the ocean? Like, nature explores opportunity. Like, nature is not going to leave that stone unturned.
Yeah.
Like, someone is going to take advantage of all that sun hitting the surface of the ocean, and it's phytoplankton. So that's why when I, you know, part of the program was like, it's their world, we're just living in it. Like, they're just this huge force
mm-hmm.
in our world. And they're these machines that are just cranking, like little tiny, you know, billions of little solar panels out there just cranking from all that sunlight on the surface of the ocean. And that's what drives our oceans. You know, those are the plants of the ocean, basically. They're not
yeah.
really plants, but that's
yeah
what we know. And that's what kicking off everything.
And so there's sort of that fundamental base, and I guess they need nutrients also.
Yep.
I mean, like, they wouldn't grow very well in distilled water, presumably.
Nope.
And so what kind of I suppose that's part of the reason that Alaska coastal waters, where there's a lot of water flowing off, bringing in nutrients
yep.
to, you know, minerals and stuff, I suppose that contributes to the richness. But, and then the upwellings, I don't quite understand, but I understand that upwellings somehow create more richness, but I don't quite understand
yeah.
what it is that they're doing.
Well, and when I teach about phytoplankton, I just think about a plant on your windowsill. Like, if you mm-hmm. want to know what phytoplankton need, just think about a plant on your windowsill. So, of course, why is it on your windowsill? Because it needs light. So you put it by the window, right? So they got plenty of light out there, right? Hopefully, unless it's an Alaskan winter. And then they need water, like a plant. So they have lots of water in the ocean. Doesn't seem like water to us because it's too salty, but to them,
yeah,
they got plenty of water. What else does your houseplant need? Needs carbon dioxide. So there's tons of dissolved gases in the ocean. So they doesn't seem right to us, but they can breathe in the ocean.
So they're actually pulling like dissolved carbon dioxide out of that's their
carbon.
Yep,
just like a houseplant. They're mm-hmm. taking carbon dioxide. They're a carbon sink, and they're giving us oxygen. So then the other thing we have in our potted plant is our soil. That's their nutrients. So where in the heck are you going to get nutrients if you're floating around the top of the ocean? Well, there are a lot of things in salt water besides salt. So they've got a few things. But really to grow and bloom, they need more nutrients. They really like silica, phosphorus, and iron. Those are their favorites. And so when they have all of those, that's when you're really going to see the big blooms. So they're either going to get them from runoff, from rivers, where rivers empty into the seas. That's where you're going to see a lot of big phytoplankton blooms. And the other is this upwelling thing. And to understand upwelling, you have to just kind of get that whole thing about density and, like, warmer water is lighter than colder water and saltier water is heavier than fresh water. And so once you get those, if you can get your mind wrapped around the fact that there's these big layers of water, they're going to every once in a while want to displace themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So like when you think of rich fisheries in the world, where do you, what countries do you think of?
Yeah, they're coastal. I mean, like Alaska, Peru, seems like, and places where, yeah, there's big upwellings.
Iceland, Norway, right. Uh-huh. Alaska, Chile.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you really don't hear about, like, huge fisheries in, like, I don't know, the Bahamas or something.
Right, right.
You know?
Not in the tropical kind of waters.
Yeah. Yeah. So what's up with that?
Yeah.
There's,
well, there's lots of sun.
There's
right?
lots of sun.
Yeah.
Yeah. So here's a little story that helps explain that. So if you believe that, if you can wrap your head around the fact that cold water is going to sink and warm water is going to rise, think about the poles. So mm-hmm. in the winter, we have ice. Like, our salt water freezes up north. So the bottom, the very bottom of the ocean does not freeze, right? So that means that the top of the water is colder than the bottom. So eventually that warm water at the bottom of the ocean, and the average depth of the ocean, by the way, is 2.5 miles. So the warmer water at the bottom eventually is going to bubble up and replace the cold water that's flowing off this melting ice and these really cold polar areas. So that is kind of what starts the whole pump going.
Mm-hmm.
And so anytime you have water coming up from the bottom, it brings up nutrients. So it's like if you have a goldfish bowl on your table, pretty much everything you put in there is going to end up at the bottom, right? So it's the same in the ocean. Even though it's really big and really deep, something dies, it's going to end up way on the bottom. So you have to get those nutrients up to the sunlit areas in order to get the phytoplankton to really go. And so with the more upwelling and the more transfer of water at the Arctic and the Antarctic and the colder mm-hmm. areas of the Earth, that's where the more productivity is. There's more nutrients. So that's kind of a little story about why
okay.
some of the fisheries and all yeah. that are northern or southern, and they're not necessarily by the equator.
Yeah. So you mentioned that you've been kind of tracking the timing of some of these things, and I guess I'm not sure how many years have you been doing it, and are you noticing like consistency from year to year or staggered, like, oh, it's the, you know, first week of April, group X is blooming, you know, first week of May, there's a different, you
yeah.
know, are there stages, or is it like once you ramp up, you stay up?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because we didn't have anything to go on, you know, mm-hmm. no one had done this. And so I have to mention that I had a nice visit this morning with the Sitka tribe, and they are starting a program just like ours.
Mm-hmm.
And they're also going to do even more because they're starting this lab where they're going to be a test for toxins that
right,
that come sometimes result from different kinds of algae blooms. But anyway, I had a nice discussion with them this morning, and it's going to be so exciting to see if our phenology or our phytoplankton blooms at all match yours, you know. And so it was really fun to start doing, because the first year I'm like, oh wow, whoa, look at all this, you know. Well, this must be how it is in our bay, you
yeah.
know. After 1 year I was just like, okay, this is cool, you know. And then the next year it was like, yep, that thing's happening again. And then we got this. And then, you know, I was just starting to pick up a pattern after about 3 years, and then everything went different.
Yeah.
but it is fairly predictable. You know, we've only been doing it 6 or 7 years, so I shouldn't actually even say it's predictable at all, especially because we've been seeing some big changes. But yeah, I thought it would be kind of fun to do like the Nana Ice Classic when
oh,
the
right.
tripod
yeah.
falls in. It would be
kind
of cool to have like a lottery on when the phytoplankton bloom happens.
Yeah.
And
guess the bloom.
Yeah. And then so that's been, you know, in the same week. It's varied by days when the phytoplankton bloom. And then our big character for many years was a group called Catoceras. And they're really fun to look at because they're single-celled organisms, but they like to chain up. And they like to chain up in a spiral. So when you look through the microscope, it looks like curly fries.
Oh, and I might have seen some of those. It was, they were just little corkscrews.
Yeah.
But they were small, you know, like less than a millimeter long, probably.
But, yeah. So most phytoplankton cells are smaller than the width of a human hair. Mm-hmm. And when we look at them, you can see them at like a 40 magnification. You can get a pretty good look at your kind of your whole drop of water spread out. Mm-hmm. And then normally we look at them at like 100 or 400 times
that's
blown up. So they're pretty tiny. But anyway, these guys chain up and they have these big spines on them. And I don't know why they have spines. It could, you know, there's speculation it helps them float because they have more surface area. Maybe keeps a zooplankton from swallowing them. But so anyway, those guys were our big characters. And then I did a little research on it. And sure enough, Catoceros is the most abundant in temperate waters of phytoplankton. So I'm like, okay, that's right on. We're temperate waters. We got this thing down. But then this year, the phytoplankton did weird things all up and down the West Coast. So there's one group called Pseudonychia, and there's a couple different species of those. And they're, people have paid attention to them because if these cells decide to, and the scientists really don't know what triggers it, they can produce a toxin. And Pseudonychia creates a toxin called domoic acid. So about 10 years ago, they had a Pseudonychia bloom on the West Coast. And I don't even know what happened in Alaska. I don't think that many people were watching. But this year, about the same time, California had a huge Pseudonychia bloom. Sure enough, we had one in Ketchumak Bay. And it's kind of crazy. And then I was just talking to the Sitka tribe folks over there at their lab, and they had a bloom at the same time. So isn't it crazy to think that the same organism, not the same organism, the same species, mm-hmm. all the way from Homer, Alaska, and probably further up, but no one's looking, all the way down to San Francisco or Monterey Bay, I guess it was where it was, all of a sudden, all those diatoms decided to exponentially grow and create a bloom at one time and one same week.
Yeah, that seems a little like it's hard to imagine what would trigger, you know, because light would be, unless it was like right at the solstice, I mean, right at the equinox.
Yeah.
Light would be different in there, you know.
Yeah, or like how could you have the same nutrients all the way up and down the coast?
Yeah.
So that's really a interesting phenomenon. And the little single celled diatom that bloomed exponentially all up and down the coast, Pseudonychia, did produce toxins on the West Coast, Washington, Oregon, California. I'm not really sure what happened in Canada, but they did not produce toxins as far as we know in what we tested in Ketchumak Bay. Mm. So we were very much concerned about it because we kept seeing them under our microscope and we kept testing things. But for whatever reason, they did not produce toxins in our bay.
So, you know, I guess the main one that we hear about is like PSP, paralytic mm-hmm. shellfish poisoning. And I'm not sure if that's a specific thing or a generic name for several things that could happen that cause similar symptoms. What I am aware of, I guess, is I've heard of domoic acid and it seems like there's four or five other toxins that different phytoplankton, I guess they're all phytoplankton, can mm-hmm. produce.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. Like, it sounds like, at least in this case with the domoic acid, that they don't have to. And there could be a whole lot of them without any toxin, or there could be a whole lot of them with a whole lot of toxin.
And that changes on which organism you're looking at. Mm-hmm. So the diatom Pseudonychia can either be totally toxic-free or have just trace amounts or be enough to cause trouble. Now, the other one, that's domoic acid. Now, the other one, Alexandrium, which produces saxitoxins, which creates paralytic shellfish poisoning. What I've been told is when you see Alexandrium, you'll pretty much see the toxins. But some genetic strains of them, even though they're considered the same species, will tend to produce more than others. So they haven't really got it figured out yet. But like Kodiak has a lot of trouble with hot shellfish, and they maybe don't need to have that much Alexandrium, but they'll still have a toxic bloom. And then we had some Alexandrium a couple years ago, and I thought, well, here we go. If you have Alexandrium, you've got toxins. And they did a study, and it was very low. They did a test, not a study. So it's kind of all over the place, and a little bit hard to understand because because we don't know exactly what triggers them to produce this stuff.
And I suppose, you know, kind of like with the timing of things and what's around, there's a lot of, for lack of a better word, natural variability. Like, it's just, it's variable from year to year. Weather is not the same every year. You know, things are different every year, just randomness. And it's hard without a actually a quite long, you know, set of data, you know, going over decades, really, because we know that we have these decadal oscillations and things like that that presumably have effects. And it's difficult to know what normal is, I guess.
Yeah.
And so it's pretty fascinating. I don't know. Are there any older sort of, are you aware of any kind of like earlier records of people that did some plankton sampling and recording?
I haven't ever found much on phytoplankton, but there was quite a bit done with zooplankton because of the because of hatcheries. So the little salmon, when they, you know, in the wild, when the little salmon come out of the creeks and enter the ocean as smolt, what they're feeding on is zooplankton. And if nature or they have timed it correctly, they'll have lots of food when they come out. But there's also times when there might not be a zooplankton bloom, which normally follows a phytoplankton bloom, happening yet. So the hatcheries, in the past, I always took tows to try and make sure that there was something for these little guys to eat before they released the salmon. So there's some records that go back from those days. And there were particular records in Ketchumak Bay that I've tried to dig up, but I haven't been able to find them, the real historical ones. Like, they say, oh, yeah, we were doing those tows, but I haven't been able to find the data.
Right,
so.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it's and then there's other areas around the world and in the lower 48, of course, that have quite a jump on us with historical data. The Bay of Fundy's done a lot. They have a really long data set and have done a lot with phytoplankton. And I was talking to one of the main biologists there, you know, because one of the things, if you keep data, you keep records, is you keep wanting to, like, use them to predict, right?
Right.
And she told me after 20 years of, you know, I was just starting to look at plankton in Ketchumak Bay, and she'd been doing it for 20 years in Bay of Fundy. And she said, yeah, every time I thought I saw a pattern, I would be proved wrong.
Yeah.
You know, something would happen. And so her message to me was, each one of these thousands of little planktons are very unique.
Yeah,
and they act individually, and they're all looking for a little bit different thing, and they'll bloom when they get, when all their stars line up, they'll bloom. And it's kind of hard to say, well, first you're going to get this bloom, and then it's going to be followed by this one. Mm. And so yeah, lots to learn still about all this stuff.
Well, it seems like, you know, there's a pretty good diversity, and I guess I've seen, well, I mean, actually in the poster for your talk, there's pictures of them, and like there's like almost jewel-like qualities to a lot of these things. And I, you know, like, is there a way that folks can sort of have, without like super high-powered microscopes, like what's a good way to try and appreciate, or maybe there isn't, maybe it just requires the kind of hardware and glass?
No, you can, well, there's some great books. And I also do scientific illustration, and one of my heroes is Ernst Haeckel. Mm-hmm. And he has a book called Life Forms in Nature.
And this is, he did things in like, was it the 1500s?
Yeah, this was before, There was a lot more work for scientific illustrators before cameras.
Yeah.
And now we're competing with some pretty good optics and cameras. But so there's some beautiful, if you're interested in just the art forms of it, there's some beautiful books out there. If you just want to look at it under a scope, you don't need much of a scope. It's got to be a compound scope, a dissecting scope. You're not going to get close enough to really see it. But, and I think that's why, one of the reasons why our citizen science program has been so successful in Ketchumak Bay is because it's really intriguing to look under the scope and look at these guys. It's not boring at all.
Mm-hmm.
And so how our program works is you basically go do your 3-minute tow with your little plankton net once a week, and then you take it home and look at it under your scope. A lot of these programs will give you a microscope to look at home, or if people don't want to look at it, they'll just drop off the water sample and then I'll go through it. But yeah, it's they're beautiful, beautiful little organisms, and you can easily get lost in the whole thing. But yeah, you need at least 40 times magnification.
Okay.
And then to really enjoy them, maybe 100.
Yeah. Start to see kind of the details and the.
Yeah.
And that's where I suppose the internet and its amazing.
Yes.
Trove of images of people with better cameras than me.
can
be a nice way to kind of start looking at stuff. And yeah, I mean, it is a fascinating thing. They're so small and so incredibly abundant. And you know, it was a couple years in a row. It didn't happen in 2015, but I guess 13 and 14. And Silver Bay, which is kind of it's a bay. Along the road system, large kind of, you know, typical Southeast Alaska sort of fjordish bay, very, uh-huh. very deep watered. And there's a lot of construction out there. So when I first saw this, I thought, oh, well, it's just a bunch of like rock powder from the, you know, yeah. But it turned out, I guess, that it wasn't. But it looked glacial like this, and we don't get that a lot here, but this kind of blue-green, very almost milky.
Huh.
And the whole bay and out into the sound, and apparently there were some other places in the sound that this happened. And I guess they were coccolithophores, which I think they're a kind of phytoplankton that makes little calcium carbonate
yep.
kind of things.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So I did a little reading about those, and apparently it's you know, they show up pretty distinctly on satellite as well because they color the water this color. But it wasn't something that I remember ever seeing before.
Yeah.
Like, it didn't sound like other people had really seen it, but for whatever reason, you know, they're in these couple of years in a row. And it, you know, there was some interesting weather the last couple of years, and maybe that had something to do with it. But it was kind of, and that was at a scale, of course, where I could appreciate a little more easily.
Yeah.
Just because the color.
Yep. And one thing I really want to point out is there's this kind of misnomer, at least it's a misnomer in Alaska, when people say red tide.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of people understand that when the water turns red, it's dangerous. But in Alaska, that is not true. So we have three species of phytoplankton that could possibly make you sick if you ate a shellfish that had concentrated that food in it.
Mm-hmm.
But none of them make the water any color at all. So if the water is discolored, it doesn't necessarily mean it's unsafe. And if the water's not colored at all, it could be unsafe. So the whole red tide idea doesn't work in Alaska.
Yeah.
So we have had the water turn red in Ketchumak Bay, but it was not because of anything that was toxic. It was a little tiny animal called a ciliate, which is basically like a little cup with hairs around the edge that run around very speedily through the water and eat phytoplankton. And it happened to be eating, they also eat bacteria, and it happened to be eating a red-colored bacteria.
Hmm.
And so that was a bizarre, weird red bloom we had in Ketchumak Bay, but it was totally harmless. But perfectly clean-looking, clear water can be dangerous in Alaska, so that you can't rely on the red tide theory.
So I don't know. Maybe this might be outside of what you've looked into, but so I understand that the shellfish concentrate because they're basically filtering. So it's
yep.
like what you're doing with
25. One blue mussel can siphon 25 gallons a day.
Oh wow!
So that's five gallon buckets.
Those are kind of they're not very big.
Yeah,
that's a lot of water to move.
Yeah,
and so they're filtering out whatever's in there. And I mean, do you have a sense of like? I mean, obviously. How it, you know, the density of phytoplankton in the water column, but like how much plankton does it take to be bad for us?
Yeah.
You know, of the poisonous kind.
Well, usually when there's a problem, the bad boys, the very few species that can create a toxin, it's when they have for some reason grown exponentially.
Mm-hmm.
So they're in a bloom state, and then you have a shellfish filtering and concentrating that in their gut, and then you sit down and you eat six shellfish, you've just concentrated it again.
Yeah.
So that's usually the scenario. As far as numbers, like, and when we have blooms, we can have like a million cells per liter.
Yeah.
That's kind of a number. It doesn't really mean much to anyone because it's, you don't know how big a cell is. And again, it's a little fluky, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it's not really easy to predict these things. And that's why the programs like the Sitka Tribe is really good because they're really taking a look at that. They're coming up with a lab where you're going to be able to very quickly test.
Mm-hmm.
So you can make all these guesses, or you can just go on the beach and get a shellfish and test and see if it's toxic. And
it's testing. It's collecting for you all the time at some level.
Yeah. And so that's really the ultimate deal, right, is you want to know that the shellfish are safe. You can look at the phytoplankton, and that gives you a heads up sometimes and lets you know what's out there. But And I guess one thing I like to talk about is a little bit is – you know, like we kind of touched on a little bit, like it's their world. We're just living in it, these powerhouses of the ocean. And but it seems like the only time, unless you're really working with this stuff, the only time you hear about it is when there's some kind of fear of a toxic bloom. And in my mind, it's kind of like, you know, in Homer, we have baneberry. Do you guys have baneberry up here?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's there. It's poisonous. Everyone knows if you ate a bunch of baneberry, it wouldn't be good. You know, I might raise my kids in the yard. There's baneberry just outside the lawn. You teach your kids not to eat it. Everyone kind of lives with it, right? And we're not condemning all terrestrial plants because of a few poisonous ones.
Yeah.
You know, and it's not like we're condemning microalgae, but I just feel like they're responsible for 40% of the oxygen that we breathe. They do about 40% of the photosynthetic process on the Earth. They're performing collecting carbon. If the phytoplankton really decided to do something weird, we'd feel it down the road somewhere. So they have effects on climate and weather and currents, and yet all we really hear about them is toxic bloom. So it'd be kind of like if all the plants were blooming in the spring in Sitka, and the newspaper had headlines that said, baneberry is coming up.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, you know, so that's kind of a funny analogy, but I feel like microalgae in the ocean, phytoplankton, kind of gets a bad rap sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it seems like there's a lot to appreciate there, and it is a relatively rare thing. We tend to, for good reason, be wary of dangerous things, but it is also very easy to overstate the risk associated with things that we are less familiar with, and because of the nature of their habitat and size, it's hard to be too familiar with them unless you make a distinct effort. So
and you know, we can see baneberry, we know what it is. If we put it in our mouth, it's like a conscious act.
Yeah.
But you eat a shellfish.
Yeah,
you know,
something
I think it's
scary about the invisible.
It's mysterious. You don't really know. There's no way you can tell. So I guess that's different.
Well, I guess one other question that I was curious about is you were talking. You know, you mentioned that when they get to this exponential, I suppose there's this whole dynamic of predator prey stuff going on with phytoplankton all the way along, and so like they're probably growing. You know, maybe they're completely stopped growing in the winter, but you know, in the darkest times, but they start growing before they ever bloom, like have this big burst.
There's a few of them out there.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what's interesting is kind of like, it just reminds me of like playing King of the Hill at like a playground at school. It's like, well, who's going to make it to the top? And it's like, that's how it is with the phytoplankton. It's there's a few of everything out there, you know? And then like which one is going to have the perfect conditions where it can get a leg up and just exponentially crowd out all the rest. So sometimes when we have those catastrophe blooms, they're just dominant. Like they just rule and nothing else is getting to grow in the ocean.
And so they're taking up the nutrients essentially. That's the other part of it. They're all competing for nutrients. Not only are they competing against whatever might prey on them, but they actually can take nutrients out of the water more effectively, and so you get this tipping point that favors, and then they presumably sort of bloom themselves out at some point.
Exactly. So they grow so exponentially that they'll just pretty much leach the water of all nutrients, and then they crash.
Mm-hmm.
So we might get a catastrophe bloom. It might last maybe 10 days, maybe. Then boom, crash. And then what happens is like if we looked at plankton right now, it would be very few cells in the water. It's just not enough light to support very much productivity. But what you'll get in the middle of summer, like July, when it should be just rocking, after a big bloom, you might go get plankton and it could be very sparse. And that's because all the nutrients were just totally soaked up out of the water. So then there's that King of the Hill thing. Then all the kids on the playground or all the phytoplankton are just waiting like, okay, when we get nutrients, we're going to win. We're going to be on top, you know. And so then you might have like a big rain or a wind and it stirs up and there's some – all of a sudden you got to wait till there's some nutrients again in the bay. And then, boom, another one might come up. Or you might see, you might look and you go, what? It's kind of equal playing field right now. Like, it's kind of fun. You're looking through the microscope and you're kind of, you know, rooting for one or not. But it's like, it could be like a kind of a fair playing field. You might have a very diverse slide, lots of different diatoms.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you go, which one is it going to be? You know, it's going to take off and bloom. And then those guys die off. And so, yeah, it gets to be pretty interesting.
Yeah, it seems like, you know, just, again, it's so easy to not be aware of, like so many things, our awareness is easy to, like, sort of not extend as far as it could. But once you become aware of it, I imagine it's this whole, like, drama of stuff as you're describing there. Like, what is it going to be next, you know? Mm-hmm. And then we have the crash and the sort of barren lands until... So everybody's kind of in the, I guess, the post-apocalyptic version, you know, of the plankton world out there. And
yeah,
it seems like it'd be kind of fun. Yeah. And just getting that regular check-in from week to week and seeing, like,
yeah,
what's going on this week.
What we've started doing as interest has grown is I have a pool of about 20 volunteers.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of them I don't even see all summer because they live across the bay. Our bay is about 7 or 8 miles across if you just went straight across from Homer. And then it stretches about 30 miles east-west. So there might be people that are tucked way up in Bear Cove or something. I don't, you know, that's a long run in a boat. And so they've got all the equipment. They've got the water. They preserve it, drop it off if someone's running into town. And so people want to know what's going on. And we also have mariculture in Ketchmack Bay. We have oyster farmers.
Mm-hmm.
And they're very conscious of what's going on. And so we were asked to put some updates out on the email. So we started doing about every 2 weeks, and then now people are wanting us to do it every week. So it's kind of like the little phytoplankton report, you know.
Yeah.
And you know, I'm really into it. I know that I'm involved in all this, and I want to know what's going on. But then I think, God, you know, you get so many emails. It's like, probably do people really want these emails, you know? And so I talked to a biologist in Homer. I go, so what's the deal? You know, should I just not do these, or do you want me to get you off the list, or what? You know, and he goes, are you kidding me? That's the only email I open in the summer.
Wow.
So I was like, okay, people are into this, you know, some people.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I try to keep it pretty brief so people don't have to do it. But I'm hoping to trade information with the tribe here and send each other little reports back and forth. It'll be fun to see if our blooms are at all the same and if they change at certain times and what that looks like.
Yeah, it seems pretty interesting. And hopefully that something similar is developed here. I'd be interested in following along, you know. Mm-hmm. Do you happen to post those things on a weblog or anything? Or?
We don't have it online. And we, the Ketchmack Bay Research Reserve, the organization I work for, our mission is to study Ketchmack Bay and the surrounding area. Mm-hmm. And then educate people about what we find.
Mm-hmm.
And we just switched. We're kind of half NOAA and half state.
Mm-hmm.
And we just switched from Fish and Game to the University of Alaska. And so through that whole switch, of course, we have to switch our website.
Right,
so
okay.
We're hoping that we'll have a better website and get some of that stuff up. But right now you'd have to kind of get on my email list.
Okay.
But I think over at the Sitka tribe, they might be ahead of us. They might be able to get something on the web.
Yeah.
It sounded like they were moving in that direction. They might have something like that going where you could just check in and see what's happening with the phytoplankton.
Yeah, I listened. There was a talk at the Whale Fest in November by one of the folks working there, and I'm hoping to maybe have a chance to visit with him for a radio show at some point as well, because it sounded like an interesting project, and
yeah,
it'd be fun to know more about it. So, well, I know that you are giving a talk in not too long, so I want to give you a chance. Is there anything else you'd like to leave us with as we close here?
No, I haven't been to Sitka since I came up as a youngster on the ferry in like 81 or something.
Oh yeah.
So we stopped for a little bit. So it's great to check out Sitka. And, you know, it's about the same size as Homer, a little bit bigger, but so it's just fun to see the changes, and really enjoyed my trip here, and really happy that Kitty invited me down.
Well, thanks for coming, and thanks for spending some time and visiting with me. And I look forward to hearing your talk this evening.
Okay. Thank you.
You've been listening to a conversation I recorded with Katie Bursch. This conversation was originally recorded and aired back in 2016 when Katie was in Sitka to give a talk as part of the Natural History Seminar Series. I want to thank her for taking some time out of her trip to visit with me, and thank you for joining me here on the Sitka Nature Show this week. As always, I'd love to hear what you're seeing out there. Please feel free to send me an email, sitkanature@gmail.com, or get on Facebook and like the Sitka Nature page there. Until next time, this has been Matt on the Sitka Nature Show, KCAW, Sitka.